There will be spoilers ahead. Lots of spoilers, so be careful, won't you?
Talking about the films, we're talking about the films. What a wonderful pastime, we're on air again. We're guzzling gin and sporting a grin. Just talking and bitching about the films.
Well, if Max can do it, I can do it. And if I can do it, a duck can do it.
Where's the gin?
I know, right? It's the penultimate episode in the series, Didn't Win, where we look at films that somehow did not win a Best Picture Oscar. Heck, some of them, like this one, weren't even nominated. Can you believe that? The moral outrage I feel makes me want to ram an Oscar right up Hollywood's film we're looking at today is the 1952 classic Singin' in the Rain, if you somehow didn't guess by my subtle hint. Reviewing this movie with me, deciding if it was robbed, or really this is just a bit of old mothballs people think they like, is none other than that dancing cavalier, Max Hufner-Levine. Dance us a number, Max.
Hey, and 2, 3, 4, two. Ah, my hip! Oh, God! Oh, God, the bone's sticking through the skin!
You'll be fine. Put a Band-Aid on it. Yeah, sure, whatever. Curb your pain. We have a show to do. And I'm his buddy, the guy who never gets the girl. And there's a reason for that. Mike, you're a hoofness loose. And I think it's fair to say that neither of us can dance. But not Gene really. Kelly can. But will he dance his way into your hearts or your pancreas? Only one way to find out. And before we find that out, we're going to find out.
Poll question.
Last week, the question most asked on this podcast was, do you think the Oscars' Best Picture bias against genre films is valid? Overlooked, or are they rightfully denied those Best Picture trinkets? Oddly, you had opinions. Where are my glasses?
Boy, did ya.
Oh, yeah, I think we've never had more.
Boy, howdy.
Yeah. First answer came from the website. Cheeseboy wrote us with, quote, for Mike's sake as editor, let's just say that the bias against genre films is the special, special prize found at the bottom of each and every box of Bumpy Pucks. If a movie is good, let it win, end quote. Very interesting way to put that, Cheesy. Thanks. Vince, whose mastery of snow and ice is unparalleled, as he's from Canada, shout out.
He's Mr. White Christmas, he's Mr. Snow.
Not really, but he shot out, quote, genre films, especially sci-fi, do not get much respect even today. They are considered simply escapist fun, no matter how many come out that speak to more serious subjects. Does not matter how much they influence the culture at large. It makes my penguins, who are Babylon 5 and Gattaca fans, very angry, end quote.
Very angry indeed.
Well, I knew someone liked that show. I'm just kidding, of course. Thanks, Vince. Over on Facebook, George Saulnier posted, quote, they are biased against genre films and comedies. I personally don't like giving an Oscar to one movie or actor, etc. At a certain point in the spectrum of quality in film, the distinctions become mostly subjective. I think they should give awards to a group of bests. The financial benefits for each would be the same, and films wouldn't drop out of memory the way they sometimes do, end quote. Funny thing is, I think just as many Best Picture winners are forgotten today as they are remembered. But thanks, George.
He's not wrong.
Yeah. We'll talk about that later on in this episode, strangely enough. Next was Tyler Stewart's answer. Quote, certainly there was, but I think there's been less in the last 25 years, Black Panther, Lord of the Rings. The fact that Hollywood relies on sequels and franchises for genre movies does not help, end quote. No, it does not.
Point.
Thanks, Tyler. Oh boy, strap in everyone. Here's the big one.
Okay.
Steve Kellner, vying for position of top essayist, wrote us quite the entry. He starts, quote, no, of course not. Science fiction can be a powerful way to explore the nature of humanity and the world. Fantasy is the original form of fiction, blending seamlessly into mythology and religion. And the Oscars are rarely good judges of cinematic quality anyway, being voted on a bunch of people who happen to have been in the industry, who, until recently, were disproportionately old, white, and male. He's got a point there. But having said that, I shall rant! There are a number of criticisms of science fiction and fantasy movies and stories, none of which are valid, in my opinion. For example, these stories are for children. So is A Boy and His Dog for children? Nah. How about The Road or Fury Road 1984? I think not.
Lighthearted family fun.
Especially A Boy and His Dog. That is, whoa, not for kids.
No.
And even if they were for children, how does that invalidate their value?
They're all the same, and they're pushing out good movies.
This is a criticism of every kind of franchise, and I think the heart of Martin Scorsese's criticism of the MCU, and genre movie, westerns, gangster movies, and noir, for example. But some of them got Oscar noms. Why should Scorsese's relentless making of crime and mafia movies be better than science fiction? Mm. No, they are not all the same. Some are just better than others. Is that so hard?
They're not serious.
This is the classic issue that if it isn't solemn and humorless, it isn't really worthy. That funny stories are inherently not as good as serious ones. I don't know about you, but if they can move me and entertain me, those are points in their favor. Comedies are famously biased against as well, but a comedy can be every bit as powerful as any drama, and potentially more so when using humor to escalate tension, as anyone who has seen Shakespeare can attest to.
Hmm. Well, they're escapist.
This is an extension of the solemnity issue that people think literature is not good if it's not solemn. But Ursula K. Le Guin, with some reference to Tolkien's On Fairy Stories, clobbers that one when she wrote, quote, "There is an area where science fiction has most often failed to judge itself, and where it has been mostly harshly judged by its nonpartisans. It is an area where we badly need intelligent criticism and discussion." Mm. Side note, this is true.
Yeah.
The oldest argument against science fiction is both the shallowest and the profoundest, the assertion that science fiction, like fantasy, is escapist. This statement is shallow when made by the shallow. When an insurance broker tells you that science fiction doesn't deal with the real world, when a chemistry freshman informs you that science has disproved myth, when a censor suppresses a book because it doesn't fit the canons of socialist realism and so forth, that's not criticism, it's bigotry. If it's worth answering, the best answer is given by Tolkien, author, critic, and scholar. Yes, he said fantasy is escapist, and that is its glory. If a soldier is imprisoned by the enemy, don't we consider it his duty to escape? The moneylenders, the know-nothings, the authoritarians have us all in prison. If we value the freedom of the mind and soul, if we're partisans of liberty, then it's our plain duty to escape and to take as many people with us as we can. End quote. Mm. Isn't the Iliad fantasy? The Odyssey is literal escapism, but because they are old white guy literature, they are somehow more serious? How is Beowulf not fantasy? Side note, I'll argue totally that it is.
There's dragons.
Yeah. Furthermore, one thing the Oscars have never really understood is the power of a multi-stage arc found in comics and now in the MCU. The most remarkable thing about the MCU was its 10-year arc, building threads to a climax and showing huge character development across a number of their characters. I read one essay claiming that the MCU was the Black Widow's character arc, and they are not wrong. Side note, don't know if I'd agree with that, but okay. Mm. But large-scale, multi-story, multi-character arcs are a lot to handle in one movie and can demand as much from its audience, I would argue, as a literary or art movie. A work that triggers thought and discussion is a worthy artistic accomplishment. End quote. Wow. Okay. Oh,
I'm exhausted just hearing you read that.
Me too. But that's about as definitive as you get. Thanks so much, Steve.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Adam Mark, not to be left out, gave us, quote, "I don't think it's an aversion to sci-fi or fantasy, but more of a prejudice towards big historical drama, biopic, of men, and artsy-fartsy stuff that doesn't stand the test of time." Or the latter part, artsy-fartsy, the Oscars do feel pressure to be up to the minute with the times for the award show's ratings, and forget that fundamentally good storytelling is timeless. I do wish science fiction and fantasy, or modern-day versions of myth and legend, were given more respect. Is there really a substantive difference between them in historical drama? We're transported to a different world of different laws, wardrobes, etc. And the characters have to figure it out in the confines of that world. See what I mean? Mm-hmm. One of my favorite movie quotes ever is from Amadeus 1984, when Tom Hulce's Mozart fumes about his benefactor's preference of legend and myth for opera plots and not the latest political scandal. "Why must we always write of legends?" Mozart laments, exactly like that. "Because legends last," is the wise reply. I agreed with Cord Jefferson's recent Oscar speech for his Best Adapted Screenplay Award, quote, "Instead of making one $200 million movie, try making 20 $10 million movies or 54 million dollar movies," end quote. Man, we got some strong opinions this week. Thanks, Adam.
And very eloquent.
Yeah. Roland Hardy wrote, quote, I felt that voting for Best Picture can be a hard task due to factors like the favorite director or favorite actor, etc., versus the picture that has none of those. Not sure if that is valid. End quote. Thanks, Roland.
I think it is. I think he's right. There are a lot of there's a lot of favoritism in Hollywood.
We can't vote for that. It doesn't have Olivier in it.
Nick Hoffman's response was, quote, I absolutely believe the Academy is biased against genre films and it's utter horse ... It's nothing more than snobbery.
Hockey.
Well, that's what I thought. The bias against comedies is especially ridiculous. If it weren't for this, the winner's list would look very different in our lifetime. So, hockey, pocky, whatever you want to call it. Thanks, Nick. Or pucky. Or pucky.
Bumpy pucky.
Exactly. With a free surprise in every box. Which, if you're paying
attention... It's a nice surprise.
No. Which, if you're paying attention, it shouldn't be a surprise. But anyway... Val Coons, knitter of Q Footsteps, a podcast worthy of your attention, said, quote, I absolutely think there are many biases in AMPAS, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, the group that votes on the Oscars.
AMPAS.
AMPAS. We should have to say it that way from now on.
Yep, yep.
They shun blockbusters of any kind. They shun comedies most of the time. They shun animated films. I think science fiction as a whole gets a tiny edge over other things because the genre itself covers many areas. The Shape of Water won Best Picture in 2018, for instance. Arrival, which I think is an incredible film, was nominated but lost to Moonlight, which was okay. I think they're biased toward what they think are important films, movies they want to be thought of as classics for future generations. That doesn't seem to work too well, in my opinion. Can you name the best picture of 2007, for instance? The Academy is also, in my opinion, biased towards whomever they deem popular at the moment. Don't say it's not so.
Oh.
It is my not-so-humble opinion that the Academy Awards are a bunch of hogwash, and people should like what they like and not worry about what anyone else thinks. So there, end quote. Well, so's your mom. Wait, that's my mom. Thanks, Val. And in case you're wondering, best picture in 2007 was The Departed.
Ah, that's wicked good.
Yeah, but I didn't know that. But yeah. Last but not least, Dave offered, quote, I think the genres they like are boxing movies and movies about show business. I'd have to.
Yeah,
he's got a point.
That's actually sums it up pretty well.
Yeah, but it is a statistically small sample. How many movies have been made since the Oscars started? How many didn't win Best Picture? I wouldn't read anything into their choices other than they represent the collective annual hallucinations of people who actually like movies, end quote.
Well, hey!
But you didn't vote. Thanks, Dave. But Max, like many things in this episode, I feel like I know what your answer is going to be. But what the heck? We got 45 more minutes to fill. What do you think?
Of course there's a bias, and of course it's unreasonable. I mean, quite honestly, our listeners have summed, or readers have summed it up better than I could. Yes, there is a bias. Yes, it's stupid. I think last week's movie really emphasizes that. They gave the Oscar to a by-the-numbers musical in admittedly a kind of grim setting and ignored an incredibly profoundly evocative and effective and far-reaching film, 2001. And again, I think I know the answer, but how do you feel?
I'm going to go with yes. It's all well and good, and man, I really love hearing your answers. They're all so passionate, well thought out. Yes, that is my entire answer because y'all took it, which is fine. The only thing I can do is ask for more. Would you answer us? Do you like to know how your favorite movies were made, or does that ruin the magic behind the scenes, or no? Tell us in the blah, 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 end of the show, blah, 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 blah. For a change, let's skip right over the facts and instead fly right into...
The facts.
The Broadway Melody portion of the film ate up $600,000 of its $2.5 million budget. That's okay. The film would eventually rake in $7.7 million on its initial run alone. The original budget actually was $1.6 million. They went a little over. Strangely, by almost exactly the same amount as that part cost. Make 'em laugh, that carefree, fun number took more than a day to shoot.
Ooh, twice. Yeah,
Donald O'Connor was a heavy smoker, so the dancing was exceedingly taxing, so much so it sent him to the hospital for a short stay after it was done.
Ooh.
And then he found out they'd ruined the footage, so he had to do it all over again.
Oh!
Yeah, yeah. Gene Kelly, wait for it, was very hard to work for. Demanding. Oh,
you mean Gene, the dancing machine?
There's a deeper. I wonder if that's where they get. No, that's not where they got that. No. He was a perfectionist. Reynolds, who hadn't been a dancer at all before making this movie, was found at least once crying under a piano by Fred Astaire, who calmed her and assured her that all this would be worth it. Kelly admitted his harsh treatment years later and was quoted as saying, quote, "I wasn't nice to Debbie. It's a wonder she still speaks to me," end quote. Yeah.
Well, at least he admits it.
As to what Kelly had to say about this first-time hoofer at the time, it was this, quote, "Fortunately, Debbie was strong as an ox. Also, she was a great copyist, and she could pick up the most complicated routine without too much difficulty. At the University of Hard Work and Pain," end quote. Well, thanks, Gene, I think.
Mighty nice of you.
Yeah. Right, so the whole plot of the film centers on the idea that it's Kathy Seldon dubbing the voice for the movie star Lena Lamont. Thing is, the voice we hear during the dialogue for the Dancing Cavalier is, in fact, Gene Hagen, who plays Lena Lamont, and the song "Would You" isn't Debbie either, it's Betty Noyes. The original negative of this film was one of many destroyed by fire sometime later. The restoration is nothing short of a miracle. Which I assume you saw an up-to-date print. The current print is absolutely gorgeous.
Oh, it's beautiful.
The song and dance sequence for Singin' in the Rain was not shot on a soundstage, but was shot on the backlot during the daytime. A huge tarp was hung over the set to simulate night. Really, though, it was the water that was the problem. See, every day at 5, people would turn on their sprinklers, which brought the water pressure down to a trickle.
Oh.
Yeah. Also, it's California, not known for having lots of water. But
no.
Kelly was sick during that number and was running a 103-degree fever. He never let the smile drop. All the songs had been written long before the movie, and some had even been filmed before, such as the title song, which appeared in Hollywood Review of 1929. In fact, that song's appearance in this film was its 7th in movies.
Oh, wow.
Only 2 songs were written for this movie, Moses Supposes and Make 'Em Laugh, which bears an uncanny resemblance to the Cole Porter tune, Be a Clown. And Oh, yeah. That's what Cole Porter said. And he was quickly shushed off the stage. And Broadway Melody was MGM's first musical. Blink and you'll miss her, but Zelda is played by a teenaged Rita Moreno, the last surviving member of this film's cast.
He gets like 2 lines.
Yeah. The part of Lena Lamont feels somewhat familiar. A lot of people mistake Gene Hagen's performance for that of Judy Holliday. Well, there's a reason for that, as the part was originally written for her. Oh. But as she made a big splash the year before in Born Yesterday, it was thought she wouldn't want to do this. Gene Hagen was well familiar with Holliday. She'd been her understudy for Holliday on the Broadway version of Born Yesterday. And they'd also worked together on Adam's Rib. All right, Max, I thought you might want to say something at some point. Do you have any little tidbits about the movie you want to throw in?
I do want to point out that that is not Gene Hagen's actual voice.
No.
I mean, that's not how she... I mean, it's her talking, but that's not what she sounds like. And I know this because I went on YouTube and I checked some old stuff, including a scene from The Asphalt Jungle where she's doing the same accent.
Right.
And a scene from The Andy Griffith Show where she plays female speeder. And she does not sound anything like Lena Lamont.
Female
the
speeder?
The accent is a little simple. See, yep, she. Andy and Barney pull her over for speeding.
Oh. Wow, that's a sadly small part.
Yeah, I think she eventually gets a name. Did you recognize Douglas Fowley, who plays the director Roscoe Dexter? The guy who basically gives Gene Kelly's character his first job? And is with him all the way through it?
No.
Oh, good heavens. He was brilliant, classic actor. Douglas Fowley, who we know as Walt from Catwoman on the Moon.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not as much of a Sonny Tufts aficionado as I should be, I suppose.
No. I looked that up to see who the heck he was. The other, every once in a while, there was somebody in this movie who I'm going, who the hell is that? And one of them was when they're demonstrating, when RF is demonstrating the talkie.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, I know that guy. Who is that guy?
What, the old man in the movie?
Yeah. He wasn't who I thought he was.
No, he's not really anybody. I mean, he is somebody, but...
His name's Julius Tannen, and he was, by a lot of accounts, the first vaudeville stand-up comedian.
Oh, neat.
Yeah. And he never used, like, props, sets, costumes, or stooges. He would just put on a hat, walk out, and do his monologue.
Huh.
Yeah, but I was like, that guy with the John Waters mustache has got to be somebody.
Yeah.
And sort of. I mean, admittedly, once I knew his name, it was like, oh, I've never heard of you.
Yeah. I saw a little documentary, a little special thing when I watched this movie, and they talked about that. And I'm like, I'm not going to bring that up because I don't know who he is. So.
Yeah.
But yeah. But anything else for trivia or?
Not really, no.
Take that as a no. But the plot, really, do I have to do this?
Yeah, hey, it's tradition.
I suppose. I mean, it seems silly, but okay.
Yeah.
It's also not like I didn't actually write it out. I'll pretend. Okay. So, it's 1927, and there's these two hugely famous actors, Lena Lamont and Don Lockwood, who are opening their latest period drama to an adoring crowd. It all goes over well. So they head to the rap party. But Don, Gene Kelly, if you really need me to tell you, gets sidetracked on the way when his friend Cosmo's car, Cosmo played by Donald O'Connor, gets a flat tire. Aww. Lockwood flees a sudden rush of fans and lands suddenly in Kathy Seldon's car, Kathy played by Debbie Reynolds. She nearly has him arrested before realizing who he is. Don tries to come on to her, but she's having none of that, verbally tearing him down for being just a shadow on the screen and not a real actor. They part, but meet again at the rap party where Kathy, supposedly a serious stage actor herself, is instead jumping out of a cake. Angry at Don's jibes, she throws a pie at him, misses, and hits Lena Lamont instead. This gets her fired, and she flees the scene. Don spends the next weeks looking for her as they embark on yet another in a long line of historical dramas. But hold the presses! Seems that talkies have arrived, and everyone wants their movies to talk! Which is fine, except... Oh, right. Lena the Hyena. What will they do?
A man!
When they release a preview of their film, audiences laugh at the poor sound recording and, mostly, at Lena's voice. They'll be ruined. Except Don and Cosmo, who've been reunited with Kathy, come up with the idea to turn the film into a musical with Kathy replacing Lena's voice with her own. It all goes over. Great! Too great. Lena finds out, leaks a story about how the voice is hers, and the studio loves her and demands that Kathy keep on doing her voice and nothing else. At the premiere, Lena's goaded into singing, and a dispirited Kathy is made to set up a mic behind the curtain so that Lena can pull a Milli Vanilli. Don, Cosmo, and the studio head take the opportunity to expose Lena, the audience applauds, love prevails, and the sun sets. Oh, and there's some singing and dancing in there too, the end.
A little bit.
The film.
Right, so here's this question, which I'm betting you can't answer. Do you remember the first time you saw this?
I have no idea.
No.
No idea.
Even if you hadn't seen this film, it's
you've seen it
from it. Yeah, the clips from this showed up. There's an old show I used to like called That's Entertainment. It would show up in there a lot.
Every once in a while, you'd even get like a 900-year-old Gene Kelly, sadly trying to reenact the Singing in the Rain number.
Oh,
well. And actually pulling it off pretty well, considering he was like 170 when he did it.
Well, I don't know how old he was when he did it originally, but how to put this? There's a bit of an age gap between him and Debbie Reynolds, who was 18 at the time.
Yeah, he was 40.
I see.
In 1952.
I see. But I don't know when I first saw it either. Like, I saw it on TV or parts of it, but it's ingrained for, I think, people of a certain age. It's just, I've seen Singing in the Rain. How could you not have seen Singing in the Rain?
Yeah.
Have you ever got to see it on a big screen?
Yes, I think I did. In one of those, in an old independent theater that was showing, like, double features or some such.
The Harvard Square?
I think it was somewhere else. I cannot remember.
But I would remember if it was the Harvard Square, and I'm pretty sure it was not.
For me, it was either the Harvard Square or the Brattle. I can't remember which. And, you know, it's not a film that takes advantage of broad vistas or anything like a lot of films do. So I think it doesn't lose as much being seen on a smaller screen, although today the smaller screen is not that much smaller. So
Yeah, I've been in theaters that have smaller screens than most people's TVs.
This might seem silly, but shall we talk about the cast?
Sure, let's do that.
Gene Kelly sucks.
Oh, God, the man's a clod.
It's Gene Kelly.
It's friggin' Gene Kelly.
Yeah.
And he's an incredible dancer. He's an okay actor. I mean, you don't cast Gene Kelly because you want a bravura performance.
Or a good singer.
Oh, yeah. He's an adequate singer. They always make sure to give him songs that stay in his range, which is limited.
And I would also say that he doesn't have a lot of, I'm guessing he does not have a lot of volume.
He's not a belter. He doesn't have a lot of power to his voice, but once he starts dancing, people have always pointed out the big difference. There's always sort of the Gene Kelly school and the Fred Astaire school.
Right.
Fred Astaire's thing is he makes it look effortless. He looks like, oh, someone didn't pay the gravity bill this month. And Gene Kelly, you can tell how hard he's working.
Yeah.
You get he's much more of an athletic dancer. There's a lot more hurling himself about the stage.
And other people. In fact, there was a quote from Sid Charisse who said, "My husband always knows when I've been dancing with Gene Kelly because I come home black and blue."
Oh!
Yeah.
Wow.
Let's just say he's a hard worker.
Yeah.
I think for the role, I'm not talking about the dancing, he's perfectly fine. You know, yeah, he plays an old silent film star. He's fine.
Mm-hmm.
As a dancer, I'm not big on dance. It's not my thing. But he's fantastic. I mean, you can't watch him and not be impressed.
There are certain people who transcend whether you like the art, the medium or not. I'm not a ballet fan, but when I watch Rudolf Nureyev or Misty Copeland, and you're just like, how are they doing that?
Well, and Baryshnikov, too, was the one who used to say, oh, he's on a string. He's doing it with strings.
He has to be. And Gene Kelly is like that.
I can say for dancing, Donald O'Connor?
Yeah.
I don't think he's got the breadth of knowledge for the choreography, but I'm sitting there. I specifically watched Donald O'Connor this time around and stopped paying attention to Gene Kelly when they were both on stage. I think he's just as good a dancer. He's different.
A little different, but yeah. I mean, again, I'm not good at judging this stuff. I don't know the technical stuff. But yeah, he easily holds his own. And his physicality is insane. The things the make him laugh, which is my favorite part of the movie.
Yeah.
When he is literally flinging his body around. And he's doing it with grace and rhythm. It's amazing.
Well, apparently that was something he and his brother used to do when they were in vaudeville, is do the running up the wall trick, and he said his brother taught him that, and his brother was on set to help him remember how to do it. And apparently it was more a case of run, 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 jump. he said he smoked four packs a day at that point, which for a dancer. I also got to say, Cosmo gets all the best lines. Cosmo's funny.
He
does.
He's the funny. He is the really funny character.
Yeah, I think he's a lot of fun in this film. I feel bad that it's kind of a mirror that all the spotlight goes to both Don Lockwood and Gene Kelly and not so much for Cosmo or Donald O'Connor.
That's that kind of heartbreaking scene in the opening when he gets out of the car at the premiere and everyone's starting to cheer, like, yeah, and they realize it's him and not Gene Kelly. Like, oh.
Yeah, it is kind of sad.
Like, and he has that look like, yeah, I should have seen that coming.
Debbie Reynolds. She made like two or three films before this.
She's adorable. She's so cute.
I also really appreciate that even though they're depicting 1927 and they're doing it in 1952, when he first meets her and he kind of comes across her, she's just like, no, I'm not doing that. Nope. Yeah, you're a movie star. Not interested.
It's funny, you know, Don Lockwood is supposed to be this likable, down-to-earth guy, and he's creeping on her hard.
Yeah.
You know, he's like trying to grope her in the car. And not only does she put him down, she knows exactly how to put him down by saying, oh, yeah, I think I saw one of your movies. And it's not like you're a real actor. And it's like, oh, that takes the wind out of his sails. You could just hear,
a I'm glad they can't see the gesture you made with that.
I don't know what you mean.
Yes, you do. She, you just made it. When she's singing, she has a very nice voice. She is very upbeat. She's very pleasant to listen to. And, you know, huge accolades to her. If she wasn't a dancer before this, and she's keeping up with Gene Kelly and Donald O'Connor.
I was watching this very carefully this time. Yes, she keeps up, but they tone it down. When they're dancing with her, they don't do the same acrobatics. They don't do the same elaborate choreography. They clearly are adjusting it for her, which actually is what good dancers do.
Yeah.
The prima donnas want to blow everybody off the stage. They want to be the ones who are the best. A good dancer, a real pro, carries the other people with them.
And say what, you know, I did bring up things about Gene Kelly being a perfectionist and hard to work for. It was his idea that Cosmo should have his own number.
Oh, that's
so
nice.
Yeah, they were like, we need to find something for Donald O'Connor. So that was partially him. And, oh my, that routine is insane. But
and it still cracks me up. It still makes me laugh.
Gene Hagen.
What a thankless part. What a thankless part. And she throws herself into it.
Totally. And she's totally memorable in this film.
Yep. Rememberable.
Even though she's being played as a ditz, I think it's sort of more that it's not that she's stupid, is that she's not quick. But she eventually figures things out quite well, thank you very much.
She's got animal cunning.
Yeah.
She's not smart.
Yeah.
She's too
and I can sue.
Yeah, no, she walks away with that. She steals every scene when she opens her mouth because her voice is just so hilarious.
Yeah.
Intentionally so.
And the thing is, it's been so long, I can't remember if I thought it was weird or I noticed the fact that Lena wasn't saying anything up till a certain point in the film.
Yeah, I don't think I noticed that the first couple of times. It didn't really sink in that she wasn't doing, that not only was she not talking, but that Gene Kelly, I thought, oh, he's being a jerk. He's just stepping on her lines. He doesn't want her to talk to the crowd.
Yeah. Millard Mitchell as R.F. Simpson is fine. He reminds me strangely of Art Carney. I don't know. Well, later.
A little bit, except without the funny. Yeah.
Sid Charisse. I mean, who couldn't sit there and watch Sid Charisse? She was so amazing to watch.
Oh, God. Those 10,000 mile long legs, that incredible grace. You know, she joined the Ballet Russe, one of the foremost ballet troupes on earth, when she was 13.
Ballet Russe and Crepe Suzette?
Yep. Yes. Yes, yep.
I just also love that there's this sort of air of mystery about her that I like. And part of it's the way she's made up and dressed, but a good deal of it is the way she carries herself. You may have noticed that there is pretty much no scene during that routine where they're both standing straight up.
Yeah.
Guess who's taller? We talked about Roscoe Desker being played by Douglas Fowley. He's fine. Yep. He's very over the top. Rita Moreno has three lines. And after that, it's a lot of, you know, other people are in this film. But
come on. You had to have recognized Dora Bailey, the gossip person who's out front.
Oh, Aunt Harriet, of course.
Yep. That was Aunt friggin' Harriet from Batman. This was the first time I realized that.
Oh, really?
I think I must not have either paid attention the last time I saw it or whatever.
Well, it's funny because it doesn't matter what age she's in or what film or TV show she shows up in, she's exactly the same.
Yeah, always looks exactly the same and always sounds exactly the same.
And she's fine. You know, she's there for 5 seconds. We start the film with a very interesting directorial choice, something that usually doesn't show up till later on in the film. We start the film with a montage, and it won't be the last one. We'll get
a bunch of montages.
And it's funny because usually that's used as a time-saving measure in the middle when we want to do some exposition, and it's not like it isn't being used here as well. It's actually being used slightly differently. It's basically being used partially as a lie.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of fun because you can hear Gene Kelly is telling this very manufactured, very cookie-cutter story of his youth. And the montage we see is, no, he grew up dirt poor and, you know, was dancing in pool halls and
dignity. Worked as a, always dignity. The best part is that opening part, and when they're showing the marquees of the different things he was in, you know what this was used for, right?
What?
It was used for a Bugs Bunny cartoon called What's Up, Doc?
Oh, of course it was.
His talking about his past and his coming up through the ranks and everything was exactly from that cartoon. I mean, other way around, obviously, but I never realized before how much of this film they were making fun of in that Bugs Bunny cartoon. And if you haven't seen it, definitely look it up.
It's absolutely. When they're doing I guess it's jumping ahead a bit to the Broadway Melody.
Yeah.
And he's dancing with the chorus girls, and they keep doing different versions of the same song. I'm sitting there waiting for them to break into, we're the boys of the chorus.
We hope you like our show. That's what I'm talking about. That's it. And then they would cut to another marquee of a different movie, and it would be the same thing at a different speed.
The girl in the golden vest. Yep.
Yeah. Good old Bugs Bunny. Sometimes it's hard to watch them because they're out of context, and they were done for better or for worse in a very timely fashion, often making fun of things that were popular at the time, and a lot of those things are lost. And I never made that connection, but this was a big film. It wasn't the biggest of the year. We'll get back to that, but it was a big film. Obviously, making $7.7 million in 1952 is not an easy thing to do. Tickets were, 20 cents?
If that, some of the early shows were a nickel.
Yeah. So.
Oh, yeah.
This is one of the prime examples, and Max brings this up a lot, of Hollywood doing Hollywood.
Yeah. This is very much Hollywood patting itself on the ass.
Yeah.
Head.
Depends whose couch you're sitting on.
Yeah.
Yeah, and whether or not you're going back to jail. Oops.
What surprised me about this movie is it's one of the few times, I think, where a movie references another real movie. Like when they're talking about talkies. It's like, they're coming out with some silly thing called The Jazz Singer, which was a gigantic hit in 1927.
And it wasn't MGM's either. It was Warner Brothers.
No, that's right.
So they're not only referencing a different film, they're referencing a different company.
A competing company.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's the reaction. I got to say, it's kind of impressive. They're depicting the reaction as it was, which was most of the other studios was, this is just a gimmick.
Yeah.
No one's going to want to watch this. Mwah, mwah.
Well, that's why they still make silent movies to this day.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny how sometimes those technological advancements will pop up and everyone thinks this is it, and then it isn't, like 3D.
Oh, dear.
As many times as they've tried to make us like want to see Moly movies in 3D.
Nope.
Sorry, Cameron. Don't care. Don't care.
Not done that. Nope, I'm
well, because, you know, I actually want to see a good story, and that's... Yeah. Let's not talk about that.
No. Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. I mean, it's also, the movie is taking place in 1927.
You're right.
Which comes across, like, when the dancing girls show up at the rap party and where Debbie Reynolds is, that sort of flapper number they're doing, it looks so hokey.
Yeah.
Then you realize, that's kind of what they're going for. They're sort of intentionally dating the number. Because it's very 20s.
Well, and one of the first things to be very popular at the movies once talkies came out was musicals. A lot of studios' first films were musicals.
Because that's what they thought. We got sound. People can only hear singing. They aren't just going to want people talk.
Which, of course, if you stretch that out, leads to that famous quote about John Lasseter taking Toy Story to Disney and having them go, this is great. We're going to do this. Where's the 11 songs? What? The 11 songs, you know, there's no songs. No comprendo. What? Not make sense.
Quick, get me Randy Newman.
Yeah, which is why to this day, every film has songs in it. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
The thing that's always kind of surprised me, and I'm actually glad to find out that I was right, is if you look at the songs in this movie, they don't really go together.
Not really, no.
Especially Beautiful Girl, which pops up in the middle for no apparent reason.
Yeah, it's
sung by somebody who's not a major character. It's not about any of the characters in the film. It's really just about, this is a type of movie they might be making right now. And I wondered, it's like, why is there a fashion show in the middle of this?
That, you know, now, that was, again, a little nod to a different, to a type of movie. They used to do that.
No. Huh? It was a nod to the costume designer to this film. Because the guy who did the costumes for this film also did things like, oh, the costumes to a tiny little film you didn't know, you've never heard of, called Gone with the Wind. And he said he actually...
Was that some little indie film?
I think so, back in the 30s somewhere. But he said there was actually more costumes in this than that, and they were way more difficult to put together.
Wow.
And so there's like, you know what, we need to somehow give him a little boost. We'll put a little section of fashion and talk about fashion in this because of
him. But they do that in other movies, especially in other musicals. I know they did that in The Petty Girl.
Yeah.
And at least a couple of the Rock Huts, those Doris Day musicals. For some reason, it's like, let's show off some costumes. I mean, but what, for some reason? Let's put women in very short skirts.
Well, not always, though. Some of those flapper things were like knee length and lower. And some of them quite honestly looks like, oh, I see you cut some holes in your hefty bag. I hope you enjoy that.
There is a lot of also, just not just in that sequence, but in the Broadway melody, I have in my notes, this is the definition of a riot of color. Because the colors are very bright.
Well, it's the 50s, so we're still pretty... color films are still probably not the norm. It's probably, I'm going to guess, 50-50 at that point. Mm-hmm. So they really were pushing color back. And we're talking Technicolor, right? And Technicolor... Yeah. Technicolor is really weird. If you've ever seen an actual piece of Technicolor film, it's not like regular film, because regular film uses a... like not black and white film with silver nitrate, and basically you cause the silver nitrate to either turn dark or light somewhere in between. Technicolor is a dye process. It's a physical dye on the film, and you can see it. It also tends to not fade. So an actual Technicolor print will last for decades and still be pretty vibrant. So they're like, well, we're going to spend the money on this. We might as well do something with it. The Broadway melody section... specifically to me, of all the numbers in this film, really doesn't fit. And in some ways, it fits even worse because it feels very modern to the time of the 1950s.
Yeah.
And
even the dance style is very 50s.
And of course, this would be Don Lockwood making a part for the Dancing Cavalier, where the hoofer of the present day in 1927 is daydreaming about something that won't happen for 25 years.
Yeah.
I have this feeling it was Gene Kelly going, I need to have a dance routine that's just, I'm going to do this thing, and I want to do this thing. And I personally love the set design. I love the big empty elements, the painted elements, the hanging neon signs and stuff. And it's fun. It is weird, but it's fun. It's
very odd.
Well, we have gangsters.
Yeah, we have gangsters that, in fact, are a specific reference back to Scarface with the guy flipping the coin.
Right.
The Frank Nitti analog in that movie, he's always flipping a coin. I think it's a nickel in that. This is a bigger one, but
yeah,
I think that's where the trope came from.
And if you sit there and don't let the film just pull you along... That particular section, to me, I'm just like, this. I'm sorry, Gene, we're going to have to take this out. It's really long, it's way too expensive, and it doesn't fit.
Yeah.
But we'll decide if that actually is the truth or not later on.
Yeah.
After watching that particular series, because that's where Don Lockwood is coming on to Sid Charisse, my thought was, because I watched too much Star Trek, what complicated mating rituals these humans have.
Fascinating plankton.
Well, and there's apparently one particular set of moves that almost didn't get past the censors, and so apparently nobody knows what it was, but I'm watching this going, oh, I know exactly what it was.
Oh, what, when she's twining around him?
No, there's actually one scene where they're standing next to each other, and they are thrusting their hips very, very quickly.
Okay. Yeah,
that's my guess. Don't know, but that's my guess, because, of course, you didn't thrust in the 50s. That never happened. Yeah.
Well, they didn't invent sex until 1965.
Well, it's a good thing, because otherwise I wouldn't be here. I don't know how you came along, but...
I was hatched.
So I'm going to ask a really obvious, dumb question. We're going to ask it anyway. Max, do you have any, I don't know, favorite quotes from this film?
Oh, God. there are so many. I mean...
Pick a couple.
Oh, geez. Lena Lamont has most of the good ones.
Yep.
Like, people, I ain't... People, I am a shimmering, glowing star in the cinema firmament. It says so right here. I think it's right there, or is it right here?
I can't. Here makes more sense because she points, but...
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that, and of course, even the little things like, yes, yes, yes.
No, no, no,
no, no. And even, I love when the director keeps screaming, into the bush! You have to talk into the bush!
Yeah, big deal.
And, I mean, one of my favorites is so dumb, but it's like, I make more money than Calvin Coolidge! Put together! Between her and Cosmo, like, the lines are, those are the best lines, but the absolute top lines are all delivered by Jean Hagen. She's just hilarious.
The other one I have written down, and it's a throwaway, I don't even remember noticing it before, when they're watching the first movie, whatever, The Royal Rascal, and these two girls are in the audience, and one leans over and goes, he's so refined, I think I'll kill myself. Like, what?
Yeah. Well, and there's this whole thing about movie stars and movie star magazines and gossip stuff and fandom and all that sort of thing, which, quite honestly, I think we talked about this dozens of episodes ago about how the movies were kind of the beginning of fandom on this level. Yes, you had fans of stage actors and stuff. The problem was that the number of people who actually could see stage actors numbered in the hundreds at best.
Yeah, at best.
You know, or a dancer or something like that. And you probably were rich. Movies, from the beginning, although back then it was still an experience and you actually dressed up for it.
Yes, and the theaters looked like palaces.
I know, and like the all I could think of today is like, I hope nobody farts during the movie, because, right?
Yeah.
Or keep off your phone.
But it was affordable for, like, maybe not the big premieres on premiere night.
Yeah.
You know, you go for a nickel in a lot of these, and you used to get a lot for that nickel, I'm told. You know, you got the, it was very publicly accessible, and as such, yes, it made the cult, the fan culture, huge. And the studios knew this, and back then they would do all those things. They would control everything, because back then the studios basically owned the stars. They were like, they're practically their property. And they would say, like, okay, you have to, here's a morals clause. You can't behave badly in front of other people. We're going to have you pretend to date this person. Oh, you have to get married now.
Right.
What? Yeah, you got to get married. All that stuff.
Well, I think his name was William Haynes. One of the biggest silent film stars, William Haynes, didn't make the cut into sound, but it had nothing to do with his speaking voice. Turned out that he was, at least amongst Hollywood people, openly gay. And they were like, you have to have a girlfriend and get married. And he was like, yeah, you know what, the hell with that. And he left Hollywood, opened up an antique store, and became very well known for his interior decoration. Oh, you see where this is going. But
Well, really done, him.
Well, the sweet thing is that he had a partner at the time, and they stayed together for the rest of their lives. And apparently they were known as the favorite couple of Hollywood. I don't remember his partner's name. But, you know, the morals clause.
Unique.
Part of me, the morals clause is like, maybe that wasn't such a bad thing. thou shalt not strike other people in front of billions of people during award shows, things like that.
Yeah, you know, your contract says, how about you don't espouse white supremacist views on social media?
Or ever. Or have them. Or, because you can't dictate that. But
no, you cannot.
The thing is that if you could play ball, there was a lot in it for you. You not only were under contract. Oh, the
money was insane.
Yeah, you would be working, or you would be paid to be working, and you would be doing ridiculously well.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, better than now, but there are still, you know, the top stars now will probably do just as well or better than back then. Remember, we talked about Jerry Lewis, though, and Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin at their height were making like immense, like $500 million in today's money.
It was ridiculous. They were making ludicrous amounts of money. And I think there were more of them making that kind of money then than there are now. I mean, it's a much smaller percentage of the people who are commanding $15, $20 million a picture.
Yeah.
Like, geez, yeah. Like, no, I think that's true. And this is actually, a lot of it is an interesting picture of that. They kind of play it for laughs, but there's that sequence where people are tearing off Gene's clothing.
Yeah.
You know, he's being mobbed by his fans. People really got hurt by that. They still do.
Yeah, but by the time we got to the late 60s, early 70s, of course, we would hire groups of screaming women to tear off the clothes of Johnny Bravo. But
yeah, yes.
Another deeper, but that's okay. And I don't mean the cartoon.
No.
So, yeah, I think it's a gilded snapshot of Hollywood of the 20s. I think there's little bits of truth here and there, but I think it's still pretty gilded. There's one scene.
Oh, yeah.
There's one scene in particular where Don and Kathy are walking through the sound stages and they're making films, and they can just sit there and talk, or maybe it's Don and Cosmo. Because it's silent pictures, nobody cares, and they're literally making them next to each other. Like, over here is a jungle picture. Oh, mm-hmm. Oh, good. We paused for racism. That's
Hell, look, blackface. Wonderful.
Yep. Yeah, and they can do a college picture, and they can do a Western train fight.
All at the same time.
Yeah, and there's that, and everybody's getting along, and everything's fine and stuff. So it's a gilded picture, but there are little hints about some of the stuff. There's hints about the idea of what your persona is and how you're seen versus what you're really like. It's just that behind the scenes, except for Lena, everybody's a nice guy, but... Mm.
Yeah, that's, again, part of the fantasy. RF, who is the big studio executive, he, like, cares about them?
Yeah.
Wow. What fantasy world is he living in?
Well...
And he's actually quite nice about some things. He's like, okay, yes, I'm giving in to Lena, but I really don't want to, and I want to find a way around it. And he's perfectly willing to take his vengeance on her. And, like, he's like, yeah, absolutely, we got to get to Kathy... a career. And when Lena is saying no, he's not like, well, that's true, she's worth more money. He's like, well, you can't do that. That's wrong.
Yeah. And what's really...
As a
side note / parallel, what was going on at MGM at the time was really interesting, because right before this film got made, Louis B. Mayer was fired. And, like, can you do that? Isn't he one of the M's? Like, how do you fire Louis B. Mayer? One of the last films that he okayed and made sure was, you know, stamped for approval was this one.
Oh, God.
Yeah, because in Hollywood, it doesn't matter who you are, because you can be kicked out no matter what, so.
Yep, yep.
Yeah.
No one is invincible. You hear that, Harvey Weinstein?
But anyway, do you have anything else you want to add before we get to... Because this film, as we pointed out, not only didn't win, even though it's about Hollywood, it wasn't even nominated for Best Picture. And there's a couple of reasons for that I'll get to. But do you have anything else you want to go through before we get to that part and we talk about what did win and whether it should have?
Yeah, what the hell is with Gene Kelly's pants in that last shot? They're like rolled up almost through his knees. Yeah, and he's got like these weird ass golf socks on. What the hell?
It was all the thing when you wore knickers.
Okay.
And I don't mean the British word.
No. I also kind of like the fact that the dancing cavalier is basically a different, slightly changed version of a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's court.
Well, eventually.
Yeah.
But not originally. Originally, it was.
No.
Actually,
yeah, it was just a swashbuckling. Well, it was basically the Scarlet Pimpernel.
Well, it was literally the Three Musketeers, because they used footage from a Three Musketeers movie in that. And if you look very carefully at one point, the actors and the costumes were different, but there you go. Yeah.
I missed that. Okay, yeah, I don't really have anything else. The finish.
So, Max.
Yeah.
It's an old film. They often don't stand up. People's interests have changed. It happens. Very, you know, everybody, we've seen it. We've done it. Singing in the Rain is about as old Hollywood as you can get. Some would say oldie moldy. But what do you think of this film?
It's so much fun. It's still fun. I mean, it's still just so pretty to look at. Yes, the acting is meh for the most part. And a lot of it, as you say, doesn't fit.
Mm.
It's very, it feels, especially the music. I remember realizing he's singing "You Are My Lucky Star" at the end of this. What?
Yeah,
that doesn't match the tone of any of the other songs.
No,
and it's like 800 years old, but it still works. As I said, make 'em laugh. Sorry, Cole Porter. Really, still cracks me up. I think it's funny. I think Cosmo is funny. I think Debbie Reynolds is adorable. I love watching the three of them dance together. Gene Hagen's hilarious. I think it still works.
So you're saying you've what seen this you? A couple of times?
I've seen it two or three times, yeah.
This is a film I throw on when I'm in a lousy mood.
Mm.
If I want to feel better, if I want something fun, something that's going to boost my spirits, honestly, I will watch Singing in the Rain. I've seen it at least once, if not twice, in a theater. I've seen it home. I've watched it for this. I own a nice copy of it, a nice 4K restored copy. It looks fantastic. It's just nice.
It is. And you notice, except for Lena, everyone in the movie is nice.
Yeah.
Even Zelda, she's a little pissy about losing a part, but yeah, everyone else is nice.
And it just makes me feel good. I like the film. I'm not a dance fan. I don't care. Mm-hmm. Like, watching them, I'm just like, I don't know how you do that. How do you lift people and then dance? How? And I'm knowing about the fever and the other stuff. I'm sitting there. This time, I'm watching their faces, or knowing that Donald O'Connor had to do that whole routine twice. I'm watching their faces like, where's the grimace? Where's the I can't believe? It's not there. Nope. I don't know how they do that.
It's amazing.
So
they just look like they're having so much fun, even if they're miserable.
This is a film that I think, for younger audiences, and I'm talking like late teens, early 20s, probably won't work. But I think that as you mellow towards family life, I think this is a film that still will hold up and I think would still make people happy.
I think so.
But the big question is, why the hell was it not even nominated?
Wasn't even nominated.
Well, one of the reasons
it talked briefly. Yeah.
Well, one of the reasons I found out was the year before. So there's this other film that came out the year before. It happened to have a certain Gene Kelly in it. And it happened to win a lot of Oscars, one of which was kind of surprising. And that was American in Paris.
Yeah.
And what I didn't realize was that it and Streetcar were out having a brawl. And in the end, who won Best Picture? It wasn't Streetcar. It was an American in Paris.
Dang.
Yeah, that must have been. And I think also African Queen came out that year.
Ouch. Oh, boy. Okay, I can see there being a bit of a backlash against musicals and Gene Kelly.
So the thought was, one of the reasons that it got nominated for two things. One of them was Gene Hagen. I forget what the other one was for.
Yeah.
Probably costume. And it didn't win either. And I read that one of the things that they thought was that there was a lot of Hollywood people saying, yeah, he won enough last year, let's give it to something else. But the question is, and Max, you know the answer to this, what was nominated and did win Best Picture?
That's an interesting one, because that was The Greatest Show on Earth.
Was it?
By Cecil B. DeMille.
Was it?
Ready when you are, CB. And quite honestly, now this movie, have you seen it?
I hadn't, but I watched it for the show because I am a professional.
Yeah, I rewatched it also. And you did? I've seen it a few times. Oh, I did.
I'm sorry.
Look, I enjoy that movie. I do. I will not for a minute say it should have won, and I don't even think it's that great a movie.
I don't think it's even a good movie.
It's just such a spectacle to watch, and some of it is so much fun. And Jimmy Stewart
is wasted.
As Buttons is wonderful in the 5 or 10 minutes he's on screen.
And you know why he's wearing makeup in every scene and it's not for the character?
Why?
He was being loaned out, and the studio that made the film didn't own the rights to his likeness. So he had to
stay. Oh, that's right. I did know that.
Stupid. Yeah. Very and honestly, silly. It could have been another actor. Yes, Jimmy Stewart is good in the role because it's Jimmy Stewart, but
honestly. It's generally accepted that the reason this was both nominated and that it won was because Cecil B. DeMille was getting a tad long in the tooth, and Hollywood wanted to give him something before he died. And they figured, well, this is probably the last hurrah for him.
Which it wasn't.
And then next year he comes out with the Ten Commandments.
Yeah, Moses, Moses, Moses.
That's who supposes his toses are roses.
If you haven't seen it, it's a great comedy. Oh, is that film
funny? Oh, it's hilarious. It is hilarious.
I don't think it's meant to be, but somebody told me that it's not supposed to be funny, but I don't know if I believe them.
And it's another, Cecil B. DeMille with Charlton Heston.
Yeah. You know why he picked Charlton Heston for that film, for Greatest Show on Earth?
I'm assuming because he knew he wouldn't take any bathroom breaks.
No.
Because Charlton Heston always looks like he hasn't taken a dump in 3 months.
Cecil B. DeMille was impressed with the way that Charlton Heston waved to him.
Oh, I read that. I thought that was a joke.
No, apparently not. Lord. I gotta say, especially because there's a lot of close-ups of Charlton Heston in this film, what's the draw of Charlton Heston?
I don't know. I think people who like big chins and blue eyes, I don't know.
I guess.
I have never understood why he was such a success, because I have seen one time when he did a really good job. and that was in Hamlet. In Kenneth Branagh's Hamlet, he plays the head of the Strolling Players. He has one scene, and he does the Hecuba speech. And he is, I remember going, okay, is that like Charlton Heston's brother?
Milton Heston. No
way, there is no way he's playing that understated. Yeah, Charlton Heston was a competent actor. He had real presence. And that's it. I don't know why he was so damn successful.
I liked him as the narrator of Disney's Hercules. That was good.
I was also, they really missed, I think, an opportunity in the opening sequence where Brad is walking through the circus and there is a chimp that grabs his hand. I wanted him to say, "Get your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape!" They missed the opportunity.
The problem I have is that the film doesn't really make sense. It's literally like, oh, cool, we have access to an entire circus. Let's show that. And the scenes of the circus, it's really funny because it's obvious. Well, we need to have some kids we know are going to clap and cheer. We'll put that up front. If you look at the audience behind the first few kids, they're all like bored, looking off to the side. And every kid who's got an ice cream cone, they told the kid, make sure to smear it all over your face the way no kid does. Yeah, I was like, what? Yeah. But it's literally just like, here's a bunch of circus acts and we'll make up this plot, which doesn't really, there's gangsters involved. And then there's this weird love triangle, which really doesn't work. Because we're supposed to believe that the trapeze artist is really in love with Brad, but Brad won't give her the time of day, so she decides to fall in love with the Great Santini, or whatever the hell his name was.
Great Sebastian.
Played and by also Cornell Wilde. Ooh.
Yeah, Cornell Wilde, he really got ripped for this movie.
They had to. They were required to do it. Like, a lot of the scenes
they
of them
did
doing
their
stuff,
own circus stuff.
Not all the stuff up in the air.
No, not the stuff you see in long shots, but the stuff you see close up and in medium shots, that's them.
Yeah.
And they, you know, Jimmy Stewart had to go to clown college.
Yeah.
And that, you know, Emmett Kelly, who is one of America's most famous circus clowns, is in this. Because he was funny.
Have you ever seen any footage of him being funny? All I see of him is being depressed and not eating or eating. Like, that's it.
Well, that's his persona, Weary Willy.
But is all he does is eats?
And he's good at it.
I don't know. I didn't know. I know who he is. And there's one scene where you see him without makeup and he actually says a word like Marcel Marceau in Silent Movie. But
he says parade.
I don't know. The film to me was just weird. It was all over the place. It didn't hold together.
It's fun. It's kind of fun seeing behind the circus, although I really could do without the narrator who's making it sound like, you know, this Olympian task and this Pied Piper of the modern era.
Well, I kept waiting for him to say, and wait, and wait,
and wait,
and wait.
Yeah.
Until the end of the film.
The only thing I can figure is this film was, you know, they love Cecil B, and this was an epic scale film. It's like, we filmed an entire circus. We actually got the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus. He's got to get something. But how many people could quote a line from that movie?
Or sing one of the songs they threw in for reasons unknown.
I don't know why there are songs in there, and I don't know the long path.
So, except for Hollywood deciding to be political with itself, I literally can't think of a single reason this movie should have won over Singin' in the Rain. Which film do we still talk about? Which film does people still watch?
That's what I'm saying.
I've never heard of this.
Even people who've never seen this movie know scenes. They know that where Gene Kelly's dancing in the rain. They know Make 'em Laugh. I'm pretty sure no one could name a scene from Greatest Show on Earth.
And I've seen it recently.
Yeah.
But you know what else people know? People know answers to our poll questions.
They do.
And we would love to hear more posts. Man, triple A's for everybody this week. But we would like to know, do you like to know the behind-the-scenes stuffs behind your favorite films? Or is that ruin the movie magic for you? And you can tell us by emailing us directly at us@maxmikemovies.com. You can go to our website, maxmikemovies.com, see how each episode is individually wrapped for freshness and has its own little comment section where you can answer the poll question, give us ideas for upcoming shows or series, or help us out with episode 300, which we're still we may or may not have an idea for.
We got some ideas.
You could also do the same thing if you go to Facebook, where we have a little section called Max Mike Movies, big surprise, where you can, as you mostly do, answer our poll question, give us ideas, etc., etc. And lastly,
ditto.
That as well. Or did I already say that? Sure. Anyway, if you have a podcast app that's your absolute favorite, no problem. We're probably there. Apparently, all we have to do is put one seed out, and then we blossom everywhere. Ooh.
Yep, like a weed.
But we're actually going to skip a week next week, just so you know. So in 2 weeks, we're going to end this series. We're going to end, didn't win. But Max, what are we going to end this with?
Well, we're going to end this with the movie that I like to think of as my biopic, The Great Dictator.
Well, the first Charlie part Chaplin of that word film. Is
true. Yep, 1940, Charlie Chaplin movie, did not win, really made people uncomfortable, and was beaten, admittedly, by a Hitchcock movie, Rebecca.
Rebecca?
Rebecca.
Now, wait, is this a silent film?
I don't know. I've never seen it.
Oh, really? Me neither.
I think it isn't, but because Charlie Chaplin would never play the little tramp in a speaking part, but he's not playing the little tramp.
Oh, who is he playing? Oh, I have a bad feeling I know who he's playing.
Yes, you know that mustache? You ever notice someone else around 1940 who had a mustache like that?
Yeah, Aunt Harriet.
Yeah, get ready for some moments.
Oh, dear. Well, I guess so. In 2 weeks' time, we're going to watch The Great Dictator and see if it should have won against Rebecca, with or without Sunnybrook Farms.
This has been a co-production of The Voice of Max and The Movie Wrench.
They part, but meet again. I'll edit that out, can't I?
Yes. No. The button. It's so nice.
Yeah, I notice you don't say Ashnod's Gimbatula when you're recording, do you?
No, I don't want that recorded. I think that could summon the Dark Lord. It could happen. Musk? Yes.
We don't want that.
We really don't.
What big deal? He's just firing everybody. Anyway.
Hey, three. Two, five, six, seven, eight.
Stop that.
It's a musical, damn it. Three.
No, you have to wait for me to stop laughing before you start counting again.
Never.
Dipstick. Three.
Three. Yep.
You ruined it.
I ruin everything.
All this for 50 cents, right?